and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and as always, we're bringing you news, our feature interview, followed by some new music from Ukraine. This week, our guest is celebrated Harvard historian and award-winning author, Professor Serhii Plokhii. Here is a chance to get to know more about this distinguished scholar and publicist and his views. But first, a roundup of the latest news. The war in the Donbas. In the east of the country, the simmering war against Russia-backed aggressors continues, and there have been more casualties among Ukraine's armed forces. 19 people have been killed in shootings in a college in Kerch. At least 19 people, reports say, have been killed and dozens more wounded in a shooting at a college in Russian-occupied Crimea. An 18-year-old student ran through the Kerch Technical College, firing at fellow pupils before killing himself. Witnesses have also spoken of at least one blast caused by an unidentified explosive. The incident was first treated as a terror attack, but has now been reclassified as a murder. And elsewhere, two pilots, one American and one Ukrainian, died when a Sukhoi 27 fighter jet crashed during joint military exercises called Clear Sky, which are taking place in Ukraine with the United States and other NATO countries. The circumstances of the crash are being investigated. And the latest on the issue of autocephaly or independence for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Well, Ukraine's parliament voted to hand over a landmark Kyiv church to the Istanbul-based Ecumenical Orthodox Patriarchate of Constantinople after it agreed to recognize the independence of Ukraine's Orthodox Church from the Moscow Patriarchate. This decision permits Ecumenical Patriarchate to use Kyiv's landmark St. Andrew's Church for worship, religious rites, and ceremonies. Meanwhile, the Russian Orthodox Church has decided to break ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate over its affirmation of the rights of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And this week, a famous robot was in Kyiv. The world-famous humanoid robot called Sophia made her first visit to Kyiv. At a press conference, Sophia even met Ukrainian Prime Minister Volodymyr Groysman. She also reportedly took questions from journalists and photographers. Sophia was activated in 2016 and developed by a Hong Kong-based company called Hansom Robotics. And the Ukrainian National Information Agency has reported the continuing shrinkage of Ukraine's population. As of the 1st of September 2018, the current population of Ukraine was 42.2 million. In January-August of 2018, the population decreased by 152.4 thousand people, Ukrinform has reported. Well, it's my great pleasure and indeed my great privilege today to have as our guest on Ukraine Calling, Serhii Plokhii. He's an eminent historian. Some would also say a publicist from the types of things he writes about. But most importantly, he's not only the Mikhailo Hrushevsky Chair in Ukrainian History at Harvard University since 2013 and a prolific author, but an award-winning prolific author who is known throughout the world through the translations of his deeply historical works and more works that deal with more contemporary themes. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Though we're friends, I would prefer to refer to you as Serhii, but for the audience, I emphasize that you are a professor, and Hrushevsky professor at that.
Well, thank you, but I'm perfectly okay with Serhii. So,
Serhii, look, let's start with your background. I'm fascinated to read that you actually were born in Russia. You grew up in Zaporizhia. You were a professor at Dnipro University.
Yes.
And then you ended up in Alberta and Harvard. That's yes, quite a yes. trek.
Everything is true, in all, and Wikipedia says that, so you should trust Wikipedia on that. I remember most of those places, with the exception of Russia. I was born in Nizhny Novgorod, but I spent there maybe 2-3 weeks of my life.
And of course, people will ask, are you of Ukrainian origin or of Russian origin?
Well, I am of Ukrainian origin, and the way how it happened that I was born in Russia was that my father graduated from an institute, the university in Zaporizhia, and then there was such wonderful thing as distribution of the young specialists, and he ended up working at the metallurgical plant in Nizhny Novgorod. That's where I was born, and my grandmother's somehow thought that there was something wrong about that whole geography, so they descended on Nizhny Novgorod, grabbed me and brought back to Zaporizhia, and eventually my parents came, followed me in that way a year or a year and a half later.
So your life has really been in a story of adaptation. From one move to another, to another, to another, each one becoming even more complex.
I think this is exactly what is going on, and I still struggling with jet lags and all other things. So it's no matter how often, how many times you move, you still have the same problems to deal with in terms of adaptation.
But you're talking about jet lag, and that's about time, right? And the impact on the body. But what about the mental strain? Eastern, Central Ukraine, moving on to Western Canada, moving on to the, you know, Olympus of Harvard.
Well, I still believe jet lag is a good metaphor. So you struggle for a while, and then eventually you adjust, and you look for new opportunities. And again, I was really lucky in terms of that each of my moves eventually it brought more opportunities to work, to write, to research, to grow. That's the most important part.
And of course, you started off writing primarily in Russian, then primarily in Ukrainian, and now primarily in English.
Yes, that's exactly the sequence. And I remember writing, it's interesting that I as many probably in Ukraine, being in the school, secondary school, I started writing poetry, and poetry was in Ukrainian. But when it comes to my academic work, yes, indeed, it was in Russian. And then my first article in Ukrainian was written for Ukrainsky Historichny Journal here in Kyiv, which is quite interesting in a sense that that journal stayed Ukrainian language through all these years, through years of Brezhnev, Shcherbitsky, and then into the 1980s.
Now, when I had the pleasure to notice you for the first time and to meet you, I think you were primarily known as a scholar on church history, Ukrainian church history, on the Cossack period. And now you're a foremost authority on contemporary Ukraine as well.
Well, I want to think that I still maintained my expertise, so to say, in early modern period as well. But as you said, I started as a scholar of early modern period. I'm very proud to be part of the school of the historians of early modern Ukraine that evolved in the city of Dnipropetrovsk, today Dnipro, at the university there. And it was headed by an eminent Ukrainian professor, Mykola Kowalski. And I was part of that group, and a lot of what I learned about the field, what I learned about the profession comes from there. But I became a historian really with the idea not to study early modern history, but more closer to our today's concerns kind of things. I was interested in Cold War, and it was explained to me that in the provincial university like Dnipropetrovsk, you can't do those things. And then I also found that you really can't write on the 20th century what you want to write. So for me, going into the 16th and 17th century, that was the way of extending my freedom to a degree, freedom as a scholar. Again, it wasn't that we were completely free, but we were much freer than historians who were studying 20th century. And then after 1991, those restrictions were not there anymore, so I could really freely move.
Well, talking of restrictions, if I can put it in terms of the limitations or the limits you placed on your own purview or scope. Now, you're known to a Ukrainian audience as the most eminent living Ukrainian historian. But I, as somebody who was born in Britain and also was for a time a historian in terms of my professional interest, I would like to emphasize for the audience that you have moved far beyond just a Ukrainian purview or interest. I mean, your books on Yalta, on the collapse of the final days of the Soviet Empire, they've put you in the mainstream as one of the leading specialists on this part of the world, Eastern and Central Europe, the former Soviet Union, but also sort of geopolitical aspects of the modern world. I can only compare maybe Timothy Snyder, who has that kind of reputation and background as a historian who has become a commentator on contemporary affairs.
Well, thanks. This is really very flattering comparison. But I want to use this opportunity, first of all, to thank you for one of the books that you wrote together with, it seems to me, Viktor Svoboda on the Soviet disunion. That was the basic text for my course, the first course that I ever taught in English at the University of Alberta in 1991. It was called The USSR in Crisis, The Nationality Question, and that was the key textbook. And I had more students in that course that we could accommodate. It was a limit of 15. So again, that kind of comments coming from you, I really appreciate them. That was the Yalta or the fall of the Soviet Union. These are things that, yes, they are global in terms of questions that I ask and kind of answers that I try.
But even Chernobyl in its impact.
Exactly. And Chernobyl, this is the latest. Thanks for mentioning that. So they're all global, but they're all very deeply rooted in Ukraine. It very deeply rooted in Ukrainian history and partially in my own experiences and my own interests. So,
well, let me be a bit cheeky as a professional speaking to another, if you permit me to ask you. Okay, you have the chair, the Hrushevsky chair. You've written about Hrushevsky, not just his historical schemes, but about him as a personality, his contribution. Now, in terms of everything that you've done in your life, do you sometimes compare yourself to him, not in a sense of self-flattery, but in terms of the mission, the need to get certain messages, certain information across, both to your fellow countrymen when they were Ukrainians and now to the broader international audience?
Well, I try not to compare because, again, Hrushevsky is really very high there on pedestal for all of us, writing on Ukrainian history or East European history. But again, sometimes questions like that force me to do that. And on the door of my office at Harvard, I have an invitation from the quite important people at the Financial Times, where they invite Professor Mikhail Hrushevsky, and the letter was sent to me to come and participate in one of the conferences that they organized. So there is this confusion, at least because the chair that I am the holder and I am the third holder after Emelian Pritsak and Roman Shporluk is named after Mikhail Hrushevsky. So sometimes I compare, and I would say that comparison is not in my favor.
But for example, you know, he spent such a lot of time in Lviv, in particularly because he couldn't write in the Russian Empire, writing his monumental history of Rus. But you spent so many years doing classical historical work and writing. And then suddenly you're in the 20th century. You're commenting on very recent or even ongoing events, like mm-hmm. your latest book, Gates of Europe. You're commenting on Putin's aggression against Ukraine, etc., and the challenges, etc. So when I look at Hrushevsky, I also see a historian that found himself in the middle of political life and had to rise to the challenge of leading that particular nation, not just by setting the tone through his learning, but by personal example. And I think you have set an example for many of us by your commitment and the fact that you've been so eloquent in your writing and commentaries in getting that message across, both here in Ukraine but outside especially.
Well, thanks a lot for that thought and that commentary. Again, Hrushevsky already created a nation and created a state, so it's a tough act to follow. But one thing that it's less about me but about the time and current time in which I am writing. This is one of the turning points in Ukrainian history. And when Hrushevsky was writing and acting as a political figure in 1917, that was, of course, the turning point of the 20th century. The work of Otis Subtelny, a major figure in terms of, again, conceptualizing and explaining Ukrainian history, not just to the West, but also to Ukrainians, comes also at a very important time in 1988, a few years before independence, and then is being adopted as a textbook and published in a million copies in Ukraine. And not comparing myself to any of these scholars, but the moment that we are living through today is really something that should be put on the same level as the events of 1917 or 1991, as Italians used to say, or someone on their behalf. We have a state now, we have to get a nation. So it looks like that Ukraine got a state in 1991, and now Ukraine is in the process of getting a nation. And times like that...
A political nation.
Let me
interrupt, because we obviously you could say a lot more about that. But in brief, from your historian's perspective, 100 years since the first Declaration of Independence, modern Declaration of Independence, let's put it that way, and 27 years since, if you want, the restoration or the reaffirmation of that independence in 1991. Your thoughts on this, 100 years later, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, there is a tendency in Ukraine to think that we are the most, unlucky, if not unhappy people in Europe. And I don't think this is the case, because...
We're not the first and not the last terrible beauty to have been born.
I can't agree more. Well, there were 5 attempts to declare independence in the 20th century. And from that point of view, yes, we are less lucky than, let's say, Lithuanians, who were relatively late also in formulating then a national project. But on the other hand, the idea of Ukrainian independence is very new. I mean, modern independence. It is the idea of the 20th century. We have Mikhnovsky, who first declares that, and Hrushevsky is very reluctant to embrace it, not even in 1917, only in 1918. And from that point of view, when you look as a historian of intellectual history, this is a relatively short period of time. So we should be not too disencouraged by history. Our path is more difficult than other nations and other groups, but not something unheard of in the history of the region.
And the last 27 years, with the revolutions and affirmations of Ukraine's European self-identification having to be repeated several times, 27 years later, are we at the point that we would like to be, should be, or do we still have quite a way to go?
Well, we're clearly unhappy with how it turned out. And this is also interesting in its own right, because the Belarusians or Kazakhs, it looks like, under authoritarian regimes in their countries are not unhappy. Or Russians embraced authoritarian rule after one decade maybe of attempting democracy. We stayed truthful to the idea of democracy. There were 2 attempts in our independent history, relatively short independent history, to bring authoritarian rule, and both of them ended up with the Maidans, with the revolts and going back to the democracy. So now we are learning how to live under democracy and how to make it work. But those 27 years were really a test of how serious we were about democratic development of Ukraine.
And I'm struck by the fact that in your Gates of Europe classic now, both here and in the outside world, you're reiterating ideas or basic principles put forward, at least in the modern period, by Ruch, about the need for coexistence, toleration, about the building of a common state of all those living here, a political nation. Have we made progress in that area, particularly after Maidan and the Revolution of Dignity?
I don't think that we made a progress. I think that Ruch back then in the late 80s and early 90s set the standard very, very high. And what we had in the 1990s was certainly basically the rule of the what used to be nomenklatura and the former party elite. It rearranged, retrenched, and found itself again running the show. And then today, when you look at the rise of, for example, nationalist movement, it certainly goes against the ideas of Ruch. It's the things related to exclusivist ethnic basis for the Ukrainian nation. It's very different from what Ruch was saying back then. But the events of 2013 and 2014 showed, at least to me, that if Ukraine, the reason why Ukraine survived, and if it will survive in the future, and I'm sure it will happen on the Ruch platform. It will not happen on the platform of this new waves of nationalism or any other or ideas presented by the former party elite.
Which is not just a feature of fringe feature of Ukrainian politics, but we see in Hungary and in Poland these tendencies and elsewhere. Okay, look, to begin concluding now, a few words about the general state of Ukrainian history writing or approaches to it. Let's start by looking at the situation here in Ukraine. History, the study of history, the teaching of history, is it in a healthy state?
Well, it's in a healthier state than it was, let's say, 5 years ago. There is no question about that. There is understanding that for the country to survive, the country has to agree, the society has to agree on a number of things, and history is the very basis, the foundation. They have to agree on history. And in that sense, it's much more difficult today for outside forces to manipulate Ukrainians by misrepresenting history than it was 5 years ago. And there is a growing understanding among the professional historians that it's not just enough to write for ourselves, for two or three people who are able to appreciate what you are doing, you have also to go outside and explain to the society what you are doing, why it is important, and this is a change. That is something that wasn't there before, wasn't 5 years ago, and I would say that was also one of the reasons why Ukraine found itself completely unprepared to deal with the so-called hybrid warfare that was unleashed on it in 2013 and 2014.
Okay, now looking at the study of and the teaching of history and researching of historical themes by what used to be called diaspora, right? Preeminent role played by Harvard, of course, and all kudos to Professor Pritzak, but also the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. Do they, in your view, still maintain this relevance and importance that they had in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or are they being somehow sidelined by the way events have turned out and Ukraine itself taking a central role?
Well, before 1991, those two institutions and people associated with them were the only people who were interested in Ukraine and were writing on those subjects and topics. And since then, we have the field that changed dramatically. And of course, one of the tasks that both institutions had was to find their place in this new rapidly changing field. There are some successes and there are some problems and issues. And I'm, as the director of the institute now, try to address those issues that are out there. One of them is that, for example, Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute was founded at the time when it was relatively easy to study Ukrainian history or philology or literature, but contemporary Ukraine, it was a different story. There was no independent state. Now we have a situation where we have chairs in all those fields that I just mentioned, but no one really an expert on contemporary Ukraine trained as a political scientist or sociologist or anthropologist. And we are trying to address that by creating now a program on contemporary Ukraine. We got funding, again, I'm very happy to say that from Canada. That's also was something that was there in the very early days of the formation of the institute, that it wasn't just American donations, from Jim Tamerty. And we are launching a program on contemporary Ukraine. So this is just one of the examples, the most recent ones, that again, we have this wonderful legacy. We have to be careful about the tradition, but we also have to look forward.
Okay, and Serhii, on your personal plans, what are you working on? You're always working. It's a book a year, it seems, if not more, with you.
Probably that's how it looks like, but that is not how it is planned. I wanted to thank the Fulbright program. I'm here, and I'm here in this studio also because of support from Fulbright, and the project that they supported is on the history of the American air bases in Ukraine during the Second World War. There were three of them, and now we have KGB files and surveillance of the American servicemen, and also the poor girls and women who had misfortune of dating Americans, and they were followed all the way into the 1960s. So this is a wonderful, wonderful set of sources, a very interesting topic.
But just as your topic about the man with the poison gun, the assassination of Bandera by Stashinsky was.
Yes.
An unexpected book from you.
And again, I'm driven in both cases by what I call an archival revolution in Ukraine, opening of the archives, including the KGB archives. That certainly wasn't the case before. Again, the Ukraine started opening them quite early, but really in the last few years they became very, very accessible. So that is my next project, and I'm thinking about it as a key element in the story of the fall of the Grand Alliance, because Poltava, that's where the military, the air base was the only place where the Americans and the Soviets and the Ukrainian population were together, fighting together. It wasn't just the war on different fronts, and it's there where in the interpersonal relations the Grand Alliance really fell apart. That's the argument that this
is. So what would Mazepa, Gogol, Kotlyarevsky have made of all that had they been alive and watching this?
Well, all of those characters are in that.
Petlura even, yes.
Thank you. I don't think Petlura is mentioned, but the others are there. Indeed, it happened to be that the place where the Americans landed, not knowing about that at all, had such importance in Ukrainian history, and really was the birthplace of Ukrainian literature. You mentioned Kotlyarevsky.
Serhii, unfortunately, we're coming to the end. My final question in this discussion, as always, your parting thoughts, impressions, what would you like to share with our audience in a nutshell? It can be a wish, it can be a thought, and it can be an impression.
Well, we are on the verge of a major political event in Ukraine, this elections. And the question that is there, and the main question to be answered, is whether the changes that happened within the last 3 or 4 years are there to stay. And this is a big question. This is a very important question for Ukraine. It's also a very important question for the international community. And I keep thinking about that future, that immediate future, and I think that others should do the same.
Thank you very much. Well, I've been talking to Serhii Plokhy, eminent historian, award-winning author of numerous books, and they keep coming out and getting rave reviews, and are as popular here as they are in many countries in the outside world. He's the Mikhailo Hrushevsky Chair in Ukrainian History at Harvard University. I thank you very much, Serhii, for your participation. Well,
thanks, brother. It was a pleasure.
And now, moving on to music. This week, we have an instrumental piece for you. It's by a Lviv group called Rococo. They're working on a new album, and the song, Through Time, is ready. So here it is. Enjoy. And looking forward, we'll join us again next week when we'll bring you news, a topical in-depth interview, and some music. So stay tuned in. And we would be happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.